has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB FM in Carmel, California.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy, Carmel, California. September the 16th, 1974. Still a warm summer afternoon out our way. And we come to the subject of Richard Nixon and his ill health and the headlines yesterday and today that he's afraid to go into the hospital for fear that he will not come out alive. It reminds me of an article done on the political assassinations in Ramparts, 1966, that all of us, the researchers, had put together, referring to the Kennedy assassination as being similar to King Tut's tomb, that those people that had any part of it or close to it would be murdered and dead. The quotation in the article began, "Death shall come on swift wings to him that touches the tomb of the pharaoh. This is the message written upon King Tut's sarcophagus, a warning and an ancient Egyptian curse. And death can come to King Richard Nixon in a manner that it came to Lyndon B. Johnson, who was abandoned at his Texas ranch for several years following his removal from office as President of the United States. He resigned, but he went down to his ranch, where he hardly left until the day that he was accompanied by Mike Howard of the CIA and Secret Service on an airplane which went farther than the nearest hospital for his fatal heart attack. And Mike Howard is the agent from the CIA responsible for the conversion of Marina Oswald from the helpless wife of Lee Harvey Oswald into the female that would lie and plant evidence against her husband and tell many lies to the Warren Commission in exchange for her citizenship. And Mike Howard was the agent that worked with Marina Oswald. He was the man that was with Lyndon Johnson when he died. Richard Nixon knows how J. Edgar Hoover passed away alone and poisoned in his isolated bed, how Hale Boggs was sent in an airplane over Alaska and disposed. He was a member of the Warren Commission who was checking into the links of the Watergate to the Warren Commission. Richard Nixon knows how Mary Jo Kopechne died, drugged, asleep, left to drown in the back of a car. His pal Murray Chotiner, victim of a government employee hit and run accident, and Clay Shaw died less than a month ago, poisoned and left in his lonely room to be found dead. He was a co-worker of the Howard Hunt on the JFK assassination team. And Richard Nixon knows about David Ferry, the victim of a karate chop to his neck, who was murdered in order to protect Clay Shaw and the higher-ups of the high-level assassination team, and his old pal William Nolan, who died by a lonely river, left to die with a single bullet in his head, and Congressman William Mills, recipient of $25,000 secret Republican funds, who was murdered at 7 o'clock in the morning at the side of his stables. And what about Beverly Kay, the White House secretary, murdered from an injected air bubble following her typing of the future, missing famous 18-minute tapes from the White House? And wasn't Beverly Kay the secretary of Mr. Stephen Bull, who is in charge of Richard Nixon now? And what about CIA bagwoman Dorothy Hunt and the blackmailing and the threatening that goes on? So the ex-president says, if I go to the hospital, I will die. And the Fourth Estate repeats this, an important branch of the police state, and nobody bothers to ask Nixon what he knows or why he would die or whether he'd die in the hospital or out of the hospital. If he goes into the hospital, they have the embolism taken care of. He says he won't come out alive. It's the ordinary treatment of an ordinary patient, but this isn't an ordinary patient. And as a military doctor said, Air Force Major General Walter Tkach, he said this morning in the newspaper out here, the pardon didn't do him a damn bit of good. There are the same uncertainties about his diagnosis and mysterious ailment, the phlebitis, whether it's above the knee, below the levels of the skin. And according to the doctors today, Richard Nixon allegedly had a phlebitis for 10 years. It's interesting that he had a checkup every year and was in the perfect condition, and nobody mentioned this phlebitis until this July, when he was about to take a trip to the Middle East at the heat of the Watergate controversy. A year to the day, he was at the hospital for his famous summer pneumonia, and I wonder about that diagnosis also. Did the phlebitis actually begin November 21st, 1963, the same night that Richard Nixon, former Vice President of the United States, met with J. Edgar Hoover in the Dallas home of Clint Murchison? When the phlebitis began 10 years ago, I wonder at what point in history the Kennedy assassination isn't going to bring this whole team down with them one by one. So a slip of the tongue of the doctor setting the date 10 years ago that the phlebitis caught Richard Nixon reminds me of the curse of King Tut's tomb. The Watergate-related deaths already have reached 65 or more. What do you think this is all about? Have you figured it out? Why is it taking so long to figure out? And do you think it's possible that the scandal that Richard Nixon is being protected from would get into the shooting of Governor Wallace or the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne, which were very much in the realm of the 1972 elections, but the Senate Select Committee forgot to go into them? The news of the week this past week, September the 9th through September the 15th, came out like a flash flood. Articles were spread all over my desk. New files were started. The first, of course, was Gerald Ford's unconditional pardon just a week ago yesterday to the very man who had appointed him President of the United States, private citizen Richard M. Nixon. The second news effect, the pile of articles I have, is on the provisions for the secret White House tapes. They're stringent, they're expensive, but it's a cheap price to keep certain secrets locked up. And it's very hard to believe that all of this worrying about those tapes and the protection of them has to do with entering the Watergate Hotel. One condition of the tape secrecy is that they become destroyed if Mr. Richard Nixon dies. At the press conference this afternoon, the question was asked Gerald Ford about that condition if Richard Nixon dies, and in his usual slick manner, he passed it over. Get a transcript of the press conference today and see his answer to that. The tapes originally were to be sent out to California, 12 miles from San Clemente. The taxpayers would pay $100,000 for a secret vault. $50,000 a year was to be spent, or would be spent, for 5 years for five people to guard them and lock them up. They must be pretty valuable tapes. Another point in the news this week was Gerald Ford let it be known, in the tradition of his Warren Commission experience, that the military intelligence will decide for us what it is good for us to know. Mr. Ford has said as he's privy to some information that he might never make public. Now, in the press conference again, Gerald Ford said he was more anxious to heal the nation and heal the wounds and get on with the business. That was the exact excuse they used 10 years ago for the Warren Commission, of which he was a member. We have to heal the wounds of the nation. That is why Earl Warren lied, John J. McCloy lied, Gerald Ford lied. They signed their name to this Lee Harvey Oswald lone assassin, a bunch of baloney, because their interpretation was that the nation couldn't stand the truth. Now, that's only their interpretation. I believe the nation can stand the truth, and I resent the fact that they have this paternal attitude that he is healing the nation. This nation has been ruptured because we've never gone into the actual evidence that exists in the John Kennedy assassination on upward for the past 10 years. And for these people from the military intelligence to interpret to us what they decide is good for us and what is good for the nation to know is a bunch of baloney. And you have to let your feelings be known that he is not the one to guard over and decide how he's going to heal the nation. What he does only keeps compounding the cancer on the presidency, the illness in our country, the denial of the conspiracies and assassinations. Leon Jaworski, in the tradition of his Warren Commission work, because he was paid by the state of Texas to guard the interests of the state of Texas on the Warren Commission, showed his CIA cover-up ability and sanctioned the pardon and the tape giveaway because Ford and Jaworski were brought into the Watergate when they realized that the team was being uncovered in Dallas, and they needed these two men in the position, and they're serving the military intelligence now. Also in this week, John Ehrlichman was squeaking about his trial. He asked for the Segretti papers. That's a form of blackmail because John Ehrlichman knows the Segretti case was put under the rug and that Segretti served a short amount of time, like 6 months or 60 days, I guess it was, at a Lompoc, the funny farm for the very elite out here in California. But the Segretti affair and the money would lead to Chappaquiddick. It could lead to the Miami provocateurs. It could also lead to money in Milwaukee, Maryland, and possibly the money that went to Arthur Bremer. So John Ehrlichman is saying, I want those papers, and that could bring out more evidence. Robert Haldeman was in, allegedly, on a blackmail stint. The night before Richard Nixon went out of office, he was asking that he and his sidekick Ehrlichman get clemency. The news this week says that Haldeman was threatening to put Richard Nixon in jail if he didn't get pardoned. The Secret Service was going to place Robert Haldeman out under house arrest in fall of 1972, in case you don't remember that, because Richard Nixon's life was in danger at the time. And through my research, Robert Haldeman was fingered by myself as being the number one spy in the White House against Richard Nixon. This may come as a surprise to you. And it's that is one of the reasons that he had access and knew about the tapes that would bring Richard Nixon down. Haldeman is a person who wanted Nixon to go into a large crowd similar to what Wallace did in the Maryland Shopping Center. And the Secret Service agents had an argument with him 2 summers ago and threatened to put him under house arrest, but the Secret Service agent was fired and Haldeman remained in the White House. And that's the friend of Richard Nixon who is threatening to put Richard Nixon in jail, allegedly. This week, the news surfaced about General Haig, who he is, what he's doing, that he's the man running the office of the presidency of the United States. General Haig will be leaving shortly, thank goodness. It's not a surprise to me that Gerald Ford found that he was taking memos and orders from General Haig. Anybody who's listened to Dialogue Conspiracy out here on the West Coast or back East for any length of time knows that I compare General Haig to those generals that were originally colonels in Greece and overthrew the established military and came into power swiftly. Haig jumped over 243 other military officers for his position as general. He represents the interests of Henry Kissinger, who's doing boot work, pocketbook diplomacy for Nelson Rockefeller, ITT, Chase National Bank, Exxon, and 14 other major corporations who own America. Haig worked with Roy Ashe of the Office of Management Budget and John Ehrlichman, the domestic staff, Fred Malik, Mr. Cole, the men that have been creating economic chaos inside the United States, giving funding, unlimited funding for surplus arms, in the same time tying up domestic money for systems of justice or immediate needs, creating the situation that we're in today. The president may say, let's end Watergate and get on to the real problems of the economy. But it's these men from West Point, the military generals that have fouled up the economy that are running the White House. That's why the economy's bankrupt. You can't get back to the problems until you get West Point out of the White House and let them take care of the battles and not the domestic scene. They go together, so when Gerald Ford says we have to get on to the other, there's too much turmoil and divisions in the country, we have to solve the real problems. And yet, there aren't many investigators saying the real problem comes because the Pentagon makes the president do something in spite of his better judgment otherwise. Well, this week in the news, we had William Colby pulling the rug out of Henry Kissinger's ego trip. All of a sudden, the acting head of the CIA is charging Henry Kissinger almost single-handedly for using $11 million tax dollars to overthrow Chile and for delivering Chile to Rockefeller, Anaconda Copper, ITT, AT&T, Standard Oil of New Jersey, Crown Zellerbach, Corning Glass, Kippers Corporation, Pan American World Airways, United Fruit, General Mills, and the list goes on. And somewhere out of the news came that mysterious 40 group that you're reading about, the 40 Committee. Well, in all of my research on the book that I'm doing called Murderville USA, on the overthrowing of countries outside of the United States and the plans to take over the United States through this link of the Office of Management Budget or the Domestic Council, we always get back to the 40 Committee inside the National Security Council. This team has worked for 25 years ordering murders, overthrowing governments, for the purpose of ensuring higher profits at slave labor overseas and also at home. And all of a sudden, the power struggle at the top is so great that the CIA is fingering Henry Kissinger, which in turn is saying Nelson Rockefeller. And the boat is rocking back in Washington, D.C. The power struggle is tangling each other. But there's no way that Henry Kissinger can overthrow Chile without agents of the CIA. So what you're seeing at the top is a power struggle which is consistent with my research in the past years, and now they're bursting at each other's throats. So Mr. Colby is willing to testify on evidence that Kissinger perjured himself when he became Secretary of State. But in the meantime, we get a better glimpse of the 40 Committee that I've been warning you about. A lot of people have asked me for books on research, and if you send a self-addressed envelope, I'll give you a bibliography of books. When I speak to colleges or high schools, I always refer to a book by David Weiss called The Invisible Government. And The Invisible Government is about the 40 Committee. And I've been referring to that book for 3.5 years of my public life and all the time I've been doing my research. So just this week, that committee surfaced, and don't take it lightly. I'm running through a few items in the news this week, but they're all terribly important and linked to the subject of murders and conspiracies. Also, Gerald Ford's first appointment quit, and that is very important news. Gerald Terhorst resigned. Longstanding friend, co-worker, he lasted exactly 1 month in the White House, 30 days. Then he realized that the Pentagon rules the Oval Office. He said, I don't want to be another Ziegler. He packed up his bags and went back to Michigan, where he can always be employed. The behavior of Terhorst reminds me of a poem that's important by Robinson Jeffers, a native from Carmel, California, who lived here. He wrote many beautiful poems, but he had one called Corruption Has Never Been Compulsory. I'll read you a few lines of the poem because Terhorst has the chance to quit. People like Gerald Ford back there are still covering up. Robinson Jeffers said, while this America settles in the mold of vulgarity, heavily thickening into empire, and protest only a bubble in the molten mass, pops and sighs out and the mass hardens. The poet will do well to keep his distance from the thickening center because corruption has never been compulsory. It is only we who stand outside the corruption of hypocrisy and murder who are the prophets of true religion. Today is a day of guns. We will make tomorrow a way of peace. Today is a day of prisons. We will make it a day of freedom. They are all liars, knowingly using the language of love to peddle the poison of death. Power pollutes whatever it touches. It makes slaves of gullible men, and it makes men of reason into mechanized automatons. Back to the news of the week, it was quite evident in several columns that Spiro Agnew isn't going to give up easily either. Frank Sinatra and Spiro Agnew have a new love affair. They're courting the injured George Wallace. They're down funding of George Wallace. Not much money, it's true, but they've decided they like George Wallace, and these two sidekicks are down with him. Now, Agnew, you remember, was the governor of Maryland. The shooting of George Wallace was in Maryland. It could be that Agnew was kicked out of office just too quickly following the elections, that he knows public officials in Maryland, he knows the police in Maryland because that's his home territory. And it could be that he has information that would leak out to Governor Wallace about who shot him and how the persons involved with Arthur Brammer got away, another car, another second gunman, possibly a second gunman. Last week we talked about Martha Mitchell being down visiting Mrs. Wallace, leaking out hints about the conspiracy to shoot George Wallace. And a well-known attorney from Washington, D.C., who's representing one of the Watergate defendants who threatened to burn every tree in the forest, has also been visiting George Wallace, for whatever that's worth. So the fears go on, and the White House is going to be forced to explain someday where all the money went to defeat George Wallace that wasn't delivered into his opponent's hands. So you can see why there was a blanket pardon for Richard Nixon for any and all crimes that may have been done while he was in office. That's very interesting, the reading of that pardon, because this is the way it went. The pardon said, no matter how controversial, the pardon cannot be withdrawn. It cannot be overturned or challenged in courts. Legal scholars may debate the constitutionality of granting a pardon when never charged with a crime, but the pardon will endure. Mr. Ford cannot change his mind. He can never rescind the pardon. A pardon is a contract. Once it is accepted, it is final. Mr. Nixon's pardon is unconditional, full, free, and absolute. And when Gerald Ford, the President of the United States, read about the pardon, a week ago this Sunday, September the 8th, related to Richard Nixon, he said, it is for any Watergate-related crimes from July 20th, 1969, until August the 9th, 1974. Now, some aides reminded later Gerald Ford what he had said. Richard Nixon took oath of office January 69. But the pardon originally, when he read it over the air and read it out loud, was from July 20th, 1969. Now, isn't it interesting that Mary Jo Kopechne died July 20th, 1969? Are these Freudian slips, or are they meant to tell us something? First, we're told that Richard Nixon's phlebitis started 10 years ago, and here he is linking with the whole Kennedy assassination team, and we'll run down their names again, particularly Ford and Jaworski. And the phlebitis could be fatal or go to his heart, and he's afraid he's going to die because of this phlebitis, and it's dated 10 years ago. And then in the same week, this information comes out dating a phlebitis nobody knew about. Gerald Ford, President of the United States, makes a slip of the tongue and frees him from any Watergate-related crimes July 20th, 1969. And those of you who know my research, who know my work, know that I believe that Mary Jo Kopechne was in back of the car and could not wake up to save herself from a drowning, and that I believe Ted Kennedy was not driving that car. Now, opening up the Kopechne case, it would involve Donald Segretti, E. Howard Hunt, Herbert Kalmbach. Kalmbach gave $100,000 to Tony Lasswitz in the summer of 1969, and Tony Lasswitz was up at Chappaquiddick the night that Mary Jo Kopechne was murdered, giving press releases about Ted Kennedy. I can't believe that any press man gets a salary of that kind. It would be interesting to know what Kalmbach was raising that kind of money for in the summer of 69 that went to Tony Lasswitz alone. So John Caulfield, Donald Segretti, Herbert Kalmbach, the whole team, and E. Howard Hunt should be called under oath to talk about what happened to Chappaquiddick and be held either for perjury or to tell the truth. But they haven't been called in yet. But the point is that Richard Nixon was supposed to be relieved of any crime from July 20th, 69. Well, the honeymoon is over with Gerald Ford. It was a flaky marriage to begin with. There was a lot of furor this last week. I was up in Sacramento speaking at the convention, the California Bar, to the lawyers' wives, and I spent a lot of time meeting various people in the media there, did several hours of television. And it was an interesting week to be away because the disillusionment with Gerald Ford was coming down with the media people. And I couldn't believe how naive these people are, that they didn't know about Gerald Ford being on the Warren Commission and didn't know about Jaworski's work with Jack Ruby and Gerald Ford. And it was unbelievable how much of a news blackout there is. And to find that out, you leave home and leave KLRB and leave your research and get out in the world, and you realize that there's this big blackout about these facts, even at the confirmation hearing of Gerald Ford. Well, he talked about a marriage with the nation, and he's been president for a month. It was a flaky marriage to begin with. Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford as the Republican representative for the Warren Commission. As acting vice president, he appointed Ford to be on the Warren Commission. Gerald Ford, as the ranking Republican in the House, had called in members of the House Banking and Currency Committee in 1972 and allegedly was responsible for killing a crucial vote that would decide if Chairman Wright Patman could investigate the funding behind the Watergate affair. Ford said he was worried about the Republican victory in 1972 elections and only had a meeting with the Republicans to talk about that. The political victory was more important than catching some crooks, particularly when the crooks are members of your own party. Gerald Ford lied CIA style as confirmation hearings regarding this cover-up. Senator Robert Byrd asked him about blocking the Patman investigation, and he said, not to my best recollection. He did have interviews with Republicans, but to his best recollection, he didn't remember blocking the, telling them to block the deciding vote to investigate the funding of the Watergate people. The best recollection is a CIA witness term. Witnesses get on the stand and say, I can't recall, or not to my best recollection. I clued into that when I was reading the witness testimony in the Warren Commission hearings of the 552 witnesses. I never saw so many people who couldn't recollect one thing but could recollect another with exact detail. So to his best recollection, he couldn't remember what he said to the Republicans on the Senate committee, but after they went back and voted, not one of them would vote for investigating the funding of the Watergate. Gerald Ford was telling another lie about the U.S. funding to overthrow Chile, the money that came from the CIA. The headlines this week said the CIA money that was funded to overthrow Chile was, in quotes, so hush-hush even Ford didn't know. Now, how is it possible that Gerald Ford didn't know the 40 Committee played a key role in the U.S. intervention in Chile between 1970 and 1973, when I can figure that out, cross-filed in my study, all the way out here in Carmel, without one investigative agent working for me? I began to think I should be president of the United States instead of Gerald Ford, because if he's that ignorant, either he's the worst liar in the world, as evidenced of his work on the Warren Commission and other testimony he's fallen back on, or he has to be terribly stupid. A close friend of President Ford said he's convinced that Ford was not aware of the committee's existence when he became president. Even though as vice president, he was one of the National Security Council's four statutory members. He worked there with the president and with the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and he says the group is so hush-hush that even he doesn't know it. To understand Gerald Ford and Leon Jaworski, you have to realize the massive covering up job they did for the murder of the President of the United States in 1963. And then you know why Richard Nixon put them on board the ship when the Watergate arrest took place. Agnew had to be removed. They had to make room for Gerald Ford, who had been in this all the way since Dallas with the CIA and Nixon. Archibald Cox had to be removed as special prosecutor to make way for Leon Jaworski, because they were hitting the CIA Mexican money coming from Houston to Mexico that had been involved in all the assassinations. Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, the links of the Mexican money washing, the hired assassins, the murder team. Jaworski was head of the CIA Anderson Foundation down in Houston, and it was absolutely necessary to put a lid on the investigations. And it's easy to see now why Gerald Ford and Leon Jaworski were called in to the Watergate affair. A lot of people have asked me what Gerald Ford did with the Warren Commission, and I'll run down one more time some of the things that he was responsible for covering up. And when you read those, then you know that he's masterful at covering up the in Watergate. He's trying. It won't work. He tried to cover up the Kennedy assassination. It didn't work. But here's some of the things he did. I referred to the first meeting of the Warren Commission that he wrote about in his own book, with the evidence that Oswald was an FBI agent, that he had his salary number, his agency number, and it was Leon Jaworski who was called in to put those rumors to rest, not to disprove them, they were never disproven, but to get them out of the way. It was Leon Jaworski of the Anderson CIA Foundation, as lawyer and trustee of that foundation, who was to sit on the rumor that Oswald was an agent of the FBI. It was Earl Warren and Gerald Ford and Leon Jaworski who were to go to Dallas, Texas in July 64 and meet with Jack Ruby, the only meeting that Ruby had with the Warren Commission where he begged to tell the conspiracy in Dallas. He said, because of what I did, a whole new form of government is going to take over. He asked for some privacy to talk because he was going to be murdered. Earl Warren would not give him that protection. Neither did Gerald Ford or Leon Jaworski. Ruby was working to get a new trial, and he was murdered in the Dallas jail. Is it any wonder that Richard Nixon thinks that he won't live through this? It's hard to believe that he doesn't know what's going on. Gerald Ford was the only member of the Warren Commission to write a book. He wrote about Lee Harvey Oswald. The information was planted by the CIA. Falsehoods. It was fictitious. He used the tax money of members of Congress. He had a Mr. Stiles helping him write it. He was the only member of the commission to sell a book for his own profit, paperback and hardbound. Gerald Ford was directly related to the Oswald's diary, the Harvey Oswald's diary. The leaks of Ford went out through Life magazine, identical to the way that E. Howard Hunt forged the Diem papers to blame John Kennedy for murdering Diem and then calls in Life magazine and gives them the leaks. It was Gerald Ford's dinner in New York City with agents of Life magazine that started that scene rolling, and it was Marina Oswald, wife, widow of Lee Harvey Oswald, who said she didn't know where they found the diary, but she'd take the money, and if they'd print it, it was okay with her, and they paid her a good sum of money. It was Gerald Ford's friend and constituent, Mr. Slauson of the CIA, the lawyer, who said in his own words that he fudged the text of what went on at the Hotel Del Comercio of Lee Harvey Oswald, and those contacts were very important, and it was Mr. Slauson who added phantom exhibits and admitted he fudged the text that went into the Warren Commission hearings. That was a constituent and acknowledged by Gerald Ford to the Warren Commission members as a friend of his. His father was a friend of his. He was a personal friend, and he was fudging the Warren Report. It was Gerald Ford who worked with Arlene Specter of the Warren Commission, who created the famous bullet, 399 story. This whole book's on that bullet, the one bullet that went through John Kennedy and Governor John Connally. It was a ballistic and medical impossibility created by Gerald Ford and Arlene Specter. And 10 years later, Specter was working with Richard Nixon as a legal advisor on the impeachment problem. Gerald Ford came to the Warren Commission, and the subject came up at their meeting in December, their very first meeting. What will we do about the news media as we do our work? How will they put the lid on certain leaks of the news meeting? This is December the 5th meeting. I have the minutes here, and it was Representative Ford who said, well, what about this practical problem? Hale, that's Hale Boggs, is from Louisiana. You're from Kentucky. Dick's from Georgia. I'm from Michigan. He said, now I can handle the APUP and the network people, but our local television, they'll want personal stories. I mean, it's a little different than the major APUP and other groups. Now, any man that can carry the major news media the way Gerald Ford did for 10 years or put a lid on the truth coming is already tried and trusted as a member of the team. I also have the minutes of another meeting in April. And Earl Warren was saying, we have a problem with Thomas Buchanan and Mark Lane. They're writing books, and they're talking about a conspiracy in Dallas. So the decision was made, and Gerald Ford was there, that we call in the president of the Associated Press and the president of the United Press, and we tell them to examine the reports, and we'll speak with them, and that'll put a lid. The effect of the meeting, minutes of the meeting, was we'll put a lid on this problem. It says, regarding Mark Lane's visit, there's a deep-seated feeling, there's a deep conspiracy, that there's elements of suppression involved. Let's, to the best of our ability, search these out and attack them. I think we ought to have the book that Thomas Buchanan is doing. Do you have it? And Mr. Rangan said no. Well, it was Lee Harvey Oswald that did not kill President John Kennedy, and it was the book of Thomas Buchanan that I mentioned last week on the radio that Jack Ruby referred to his psychiatrist in regarding new trial. The book of Buchanan stated very clearly the true facts of the assassination, and it was Gerald Ford who sat at those meetings when this information was passed up. Well, when you read the June 23rd meeting, 1972, of Richard Nixon in the Oval Office in the White House between Richard Nixon and Robert Haldeman, and we've mentioned this before on the air, it's so important because it did not concern the entry into the Democratic National Headquarters. It concerned the Bay of Pigs. And you see, when they got into the investigation, when the FBI started to investigate the Watergate affair, What they found was that they'd run to the E. Howard Hunt, who had worked in Mexico City with Oswald, David Ferry, Clay Shaw. If he didn't see Oswald directly, he worked with people who did know Oswald, such as David Ferry. They were getting into Frank Sturgis, alias Frank Fiorino. They were getting into the CIA foundations in Houston. Richard Nixon involved the Bay of Pigs operation, working with Barker and Hunt and Sturgis 10 years earlier. They had to call in Gerald Ford. They were getting into Richard Helms' work. They mentioned real Richard Helms in the past. And the Watergate would uncover William Sullivan of Division 5 of the FBI, who was working with Robert Mardian and James McCord and John Ehrlichman, stealing information from J. Edgar Hoover's desk. So the opening up of the Watergate was spilling all the way back to Dallas, because all these same people that I've listed were involved. And when you get back to the June 23rd meeting, you see 1972. I'll repeat the language on this show because it ties in with why Richard Nixon is desperate and why Gerald Ford has to help cover up these tapes and leave them out there. And if Richard Nixon dies or is murdered, the tapes will never be heard or seen. Because here's a sample of that June 23rd tape one more time. These are some of the words. It says the FBI, this is between Robert Haldeman and Richard Nixon. These are some of the sentences. The FBI is not under control. Gray doesn't know exactly how to control them. The only way to handle this is to have Walters of the CIA call Pat Gray and say, stay the hell out of this. This is business here. We don't want you to go any further on it. This is CIA. They've traced the money. The only way to stop them is from White House instructions. It's got to be Helms. We protected Helms from one hell of a lot of things. This Hunt, E. Howard Hunt, that'll uncover a lot of things. You'll open that scab there, a hell of a lot of things. It would be detrimental to go any further. It involves the Cubans and Hunt and a lot of hanky-panky. We have nothing to do with ourselves. And when you get into this, the problem is it'll open the whole Bay of Pigs thing, and the president feels, I don't go into details, don't list them. These people are plugging for, and there's a deletion, just say, and then there's another deletion. It's very bad to have that fellow, E. Howard Hunt, he knows too damn much. If he was involved, you happen to know that? If he gets out, this is all involved in the Cuba thing. It'd be a fiasco. It'd make the CIA look bad. It's going to make Hunt look bad. It's likely to blow the whole Bay of Pigs thing, which we think would be bad for the country at this time. Just tell them, lay off. Helms is not the one to. I just say, look, because of the Hunt involvement, the whole cover, basically this. I'm reading the June 23rd meeting, 1972, the meeting that brought Richard Nixon out of the Oval Office. Nothing to do with the Watergate Hotel, but the whole team that was involved in the Kennedy assassination. And now all the way up through the Wallace shooting, Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, they're caught at the Watergate Hotel. Back to the June 23rd meeting. It said it tracks back to the Bay of Pigs. It tracks back to other leads that run out to people who had no involvement in this except by contacts and connections. It raises areas liable to, it goes to areas liable to be raised. The whole problem. He said, we'll be very happy to be helpful. Handle anything you want. The point John makes, this is John Mitchell, the Bureau going on this because they don't know what they're uncovering. They'll continue to pursue it. They don't need to because they already have their charges against these men and they're going to pursue it. One thing Helms did raise, he said, Gray, why did they think they ran into a CIA thing? And Gray said, because of the characters involved and the amount of money involved and a lot of dough. I have read that, but it's important. And I reached into my research to just this week for something that I sent out in lieu of the rumors of Richard Nixon believing he's going to be killed. In 1970, I was making out my Christmas cards, the year of 69, 1970, and I was very depressed the way the world was going, America in particular. So I made myself a little 10-page newspaper, and I had 1,000 pages made, and it was a little 10-page newspaper. And on the front, it said, Happy New Year. And 1,000 copies went out. They went to 600 of them, to every member of Congress, members of the press, college presidents, law schools, lawyers, public officials, all the well-known members of the news media. And I had columns on each of these 11 pages with a lesson or a New Year's greeting to all these different groups. There was a section on the age of specialization on the various researchers looking into assassinations. There were greetings to Richard Nixon. There was a description of what a coup d'etat is. A blast at Lyndon Johnson. I refer to Leon Jaworski in that article, 1970, before his name was a household word. I had a message for Senator Kennedy, one on how Congress is dead. There was one on the Democratic Party being a total failure. A message for the news media, for the blacks, for Jews. The fact that they would lose Israel when the oil pinch came in, and it came 4 years later, and you'll see the course of the news as it takes it. But as I wrote to Richard Nixon, New Year's Day, or beginning of the year, there was an article in the New York Times by Mr. Sulzberger said the first order of business is to clear the U.S. name. And he was telling how desperate America was, how unhealthy it was, the Allies didn't trust us, the name of the U.S. was going down, and we needed a strong leader. And he said the first order of business, Mr. Sulzberger suggested that he clear the U.S. name. So I had a quotation there from Carl Jaspers' book on called The Future of Germany, in which he said the most important thing in the entire world is to clear up the Kennedy assassination, that America is living under a falsehood, and that the crime is unsolved politically. It's almost as fatal as the assassination itself. And this goes back to the King Tut belief. He said it is fatal not to go into it. So I wrote a little message to Richard Nixon. It's called New Year's Greeting to Richard Nixon, 1970. And this is what I said. Not only did you inherit Johnson's war, you find yourself with the compounded errors and the consequences of those lies from the Johnson-Warren Commission report. A festering National Archive now holds the facts of whether you're going to be able to die a natural death or be assassinated also. Your fate as husband, father, president depends on knowing all the truths. If persons knowing or planning assassinations are high in government positions, and if you do not dance to their tune, you will join the company of the already murdered. There is no way out of this one, Richard Nixon. Who ever dreamt, after playing all their roles, it could end this way? Now, you have to agree that's pretty prophetic, because the man had just really been in power a short time, and this was my feeling about where his power was going to go, and that eventually the secret team would murder him because the people that were tainted by the Kennedy assassination would go down when they were no longer usable. The morning paper today, September the 16th, 1974, has a somber look at the Mideast. It's by Joseph Alsop. And he says, it is a rough rule of thumb that when the Arabs reach a superiority in weapons of 4-1 over the Israelis, the temptation to go to war becomes irresistible to them. Their weapon superiority today is in the order of 3-1. And he said, to put it blunt, the Europeans have turned against the Israelis in the same way the British and French turned against the wretched Czechoslovaks in the Hitler time. And in my message to the Jews, they were in a state of euphoria in 1970 that Israel was doing well. And I forewarned to about the state that they are in now, 4 years later, that their complacency would be over in a short time, and that the welfare of Israel also hinged upon seeing how the ruling class had killed John Kennedy, because it was the oil clique from the Southwest and also the North and the Rockefeller Prophets, the Exxon and the Standard, the Seven Sisters, the oil companies, that were making a deal with the Arab countries, and they were very well represented on the Warren Commission. So when you get large oil corporations and you got accredited Nazis from Germany living in the Dallas-Fort Worth area or Muscle Shoals, Alabama, giving the directions for a conspiracy, how complacent could the Jews be in the future when that much power is given to known Nazis and anti-Semites? But that didn't seem to worry the Jewish community. I've contacted the Anti-Defamation League and various Jewish leaders throughout the United States in these past years, and they still are very complacent, and I feel sorry for them, but there's nothing I can do about that. I keep doing my work the best I can. And the Central Intelligence Agency is getting closer examination under the spotlight of a few people because of the story of the Chile involvement coming out. And once again, Daniel Ellsberg has surfaced this week, speaking of the invisible government, the CIA, the outside of congressional control, and he referred to that 40 committee. Victor Marchetti is quoted as saying the CIA was supposed to be saving the world for democracy, but it props up every corrupt dictator. David Weiss, the author of The Invisible Government, was testifying in Congress. He also wrote The Politics of Lying, about the CIA's own Army, Air Force, and Navy, their political operations. A lot of this is coming out now. I think it's important to write to the Senate Judiciary, the House rather, and tell them your feelings about Mr. Rockefeller, very much a part of the secret team, the large multinational corporations. Do you want Rockefeller for a vice president? You got Ford, you got Jaworski. Now write your letters and express your voices about these men continuing their power from inside the White House. Well, Dialogue Conspiracy comes to an end this week. Richard Nixon's in trouble, and he knows it. We'll see what unfolds this week. In the meanwhile, take care of yourself. And if you're not part of the secret team, you have a better chance of surviving than their members. I'll see you next week. Take care.
It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.